Last Saturday morning, my granddaughter, Dylan, she of the missing ice cream bar fame, was told by my daughter, her mother, to get ready for softball. She had a softball game that day, and she said, "Dylan, you need to go get ready." So Dylan went away to her room, and then she came back and said, "Mom, I can't find my outfit." Well, my son-in-law almost had a heart attack when he heard that terminology. He's a baseball coach. He's played baseball all his life. He said, "Honey, it's not an outfit. It's a uniform. You don't wear a baseball outfit. You wear a uniform. Go put your uniform on and find that." And I'm intrigued and fascinated by that example because it's kind of a great illustration of how we raise our kids. We teach them that they must use and find their correct uniform and wear that uniform and understand what team they're on. You got to know what team you're on, and you have to know who you're playing against. You have to know who your teammates are, and then you have to know the opposition as well. What's the opposing team? What does that look like? And sometimes that translates into rivalries. I mean, yesterday here in Dallas, we had a rivalry that was illustrated. We had an army of people in burnt orange that showed up at the Cotton Bowl, 25% of an army, and 25% of an army of people wearing red and white for Oklahoma. And, you know, what's fascinating is there were even husband and wife couples, one wearing burnt orange and one wearing red and white. And so that's a testament to the fact that for one weekend, they could endure, their marriage could endure this rivalry, this tension, as they rooted for different teams. But again, that shows that it was a friendly rivalry. Now, the word on the street is that Reverend Elizabeth Mosley, when she played rugby in college, that she terrorized the other teams with her physical play and her ability to tackle and run with the ball. And Elizabeth, I imagine that you took note of who was wearing your team colors and who was wearing the other team colors so that you could know which goal line to score and which one to defend against. I mean, that's how we play the game. You have to learn that if you're going to play the game. But those are the friendly rivalries. Those are the games that we play. It gets more serious than that as the stakes get higher. This coming week, we will see the hearings for confirmation of the nominee, Amy Coney Barrett. And you will see a lot of energy around the issue of abortion, which even within the Christian community, there's a lot of strong feeling around the issue of abortion. And so we will discover that the dogma lives loudly within a lot of people as they struggle with this. And they understand who's with them and who is against them regarding this issue. We'll see it in 3 weeks with the presidential election. We'll see the people wearing the badges and the signs and the banners as it culminates in a vote in the first week of November. A lot of energy. And it's us against them, Democrats and Republicans, both vying for the precious independent vote and both vying for the precious swing states in the Electoral College. And what happens, whether we intend it or not, is we begin to see life in dichotomies. Are you this or are you that? Make up your mind. It's absolute. This is the way it is. You're either this or you're that. You're for us or you're against us. And I think that that's confusing to children because that's not necessarily the way they experience their lives. As they experience the complexity, the cognitive complexity of the world and the wonder, they don't necessarily see that it's either this or that. There's a lot of things that you could do. I'm reminded of when I was in elementary school and I had my bicycle, I'd ride my bike to school, and it turned out that the day the school let out, that our elementary school was also used for voting. It was a place that people could go and cast a ballot. And as I was beginning to leave and wheeling my bicycle out to go to the crosswalk, there was a table set up, and I think it was the correct distance away from the actual voting place, where people were giving out decals, bumper stickers, for their candidates. And they had a stack of these bumper stickers that were the exact color of my bicycle. And I said to myself, that really looks cool. And it would look even cooler on my bicycle because it matches. So I took that bumper sticker and they gave me one. They were happy to give me one. And I put it on the chain guard of my bicycle and rode home proudly brandishing it. Well, I got home and then my dad came home and he looked and he saw the names Kennedy Johnson on my bicycle and he promptly removed that from my bicycle and tossed the bumper sticker away. It's not that he was opposed to Democrats in general, but he was an independent and at this particular time, he was not voting for Kennedy or for Johnson. And as a kid, I didn't really understand that. Why did we have to throw it away? It looked really good on my bicycle, but a couple of days later, I did understand, you see, because I had heard that, you know, if Kennedy got elected, we'd all have to wear uniforms when we went to school because he was Catholic. And I didn't want to do that because I like to wear blue jeans. I didn't want to wear a uniform. I wanted to look like Roy Rogers. And Roy Rogers didn't wear a uniform. Roy Rogers wore blue jeans. And all good cowboys wore blue jeans, so that's what I wanted. And I understood why I should no longer root for that candidate, but he got elected anyway. I did come to understand that. And a couple of years later, at our same school, we formed a procession. You could tell there was something different that day in the air. When our teacher said, no, we're not studying science right now, we're all going to line up and form a procession outside the school. And we did, and it was fun because it was different. And we were outdoors, and it felt free, and there was fresh air. And then we started walking. We'd never done that before. We walked out off the campus of the school. We walked 3 blocks away from our school, and we went to Broadway there in San Antonio, Broadway, and we lined the streets of Broadway. And we were waiting, and finally the motorcade came. And there in the convertible in the first car was President Kennedy, and he was sitting up on the back of the car, and he was waving to us, and we waved to him. It went by pretty quickly, but we got to see the president. And so walking back, we were excited, and we were talking amongst ourselves, a lot of energy going on. I went home and told my parents I'd seen the president. The next day, we were studying science when all of a sudden the door opened. Somebody came in and whispered something to our teacher, and she stopped teaching science. Instead, she started crying. And after an amount of time that she could compose herself, she shared with us that the president had been shot. That he had been in the same car, the same convertible, waving to people, and he'd been shot in a different city. And that was hard to understand as a child. Why would somebody want to shoot the president? He was just waving at people. It's hard to grasp the battle lines, hard to understand the lines of demarcation, hard to understand when some people love someone and other people hate that person. And we understand that we want life to be neat and we want people to wear their appropriate uniform and self-identify so we can say, those are the good people and those are the bad people. And life is simple and just stay away from the bad people and go with the good people. But Jesus wasn't like that. Jesus wasn't like that. Jesus didn't seem to recognize, maybe he didn't see it. Maybe he had no common sense. He didn't seem to recognize those lines, those boundaries by which you would have nothing to do with those people and only be with those people. So listen, if you will, to this scripture from the Gospel of Matthew, in which he talks to one of those people. When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, appealing to him and saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed in terrible distress. And he said to him, I will come and cure him. And the centurion answered, Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only speak the word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and the slave does it. When Jesus heard him, he was amazed. And he said to those who followed him, truly I tell you, And no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and will eat with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the heirs of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And to the centurion, Jesus said, go, let it be done according to your faith. And the servant was healed in that hour. May the Lord bless the reading of this word. You see, right at the beginning of that text, it says the centurion came to appeal to him. Oh, whoa, time out right there. That's wrong. The Roman soldier came to speak to Jesus? That can't be, and it shouldn't be allowed. First of all, why would the Roman soldier want to come to speak to Jesus? The Romans were in control. They had conquered, the Jews there in Judea. They were in charge. They had their many gods. They had their technology. They had their medical arts. Why would he need to consult with Jesus? And why would he do it anyway? Even if he needed to, why would he do it? It must have been a humiliating and humbling experience as a proud Roman to have to admit that you needed the help and assistance of a Jew. And yet there the Roman centurion seemed to be willing to do that with some sort of degree of humility. But even if he was willing, why would Jesus entertain it? Jesus must have known these are the conquerors, these are the people that are denying us our freedom. Jesus should have repelled him, or better yet, the disciples who seemed really good at keeping children away from him. They should have told him, he can't see you right now. You're not welcome. Go. Leave these premises right now. But they didn't. And then I say to myself, okay, wait a minute. I get it. This was strictly off the books. This was not official business. This was not a directive from Rome. This was nothing from Caesar. This was a personal favor. The centurion needed something. He didn't want to advertise it. He was just coming, just like Nicodemus came under the cover of night. Wasn't representing the Sanhedrin to talk in official negotiations with Jesus, but rather one individual seeking out the other to ask for a favor, if you will. I mean, after all, what would Pilate have said? Or Caesar, Julius Caesar, have said if he realized that one of his soldiers was going to talk to Jesus and going to ask for a favor? But Jesus entertained it, and not only that, he said, okay. I mean, okay. You need help? Okay, I'll help you. In fact, I'll go to your house. Are you kidding me? At the very least, besides being a Roman oppressor, the Roman was a Gentile. And devout Jews did not go to the homes of Gentiles. What was Jesus thinking? You know, Jesus must have been a handful. Imagine being his handler. Lord, with all due respect, we really can't do that, and we're trying to keep to your schedule today. You're very busy, sir. You really can't just go off script here and go to some home of a stranger that we don't know. We can't provide security for you there. You've got a banquet, a luncheon at 12:30. We just can't fit this in. Besides that, imagine on the front page of the Jerusalem Star, if they had a picture of you with a Roman soldier, the optics of that would be awful. Anyway, you would alienate the base, Lord, and we don't want to do that. So let's stick with the program. You know, Jesus was hard to handle. I think what's ironic is the one person who stepped in and intervened and said, no, that can't happen, was the centurion himself. When Jesus suggested that he would go to his home, he said, no, Lord, that can't happen. I mean, I'm familiar with your law, and you're not allowed to come to my home. And besides that, I wouldn't put you in that predicament. That's not what I'm looking for. I know how authority works. I respect your authority. I understand what you're able to accomplish. And the way that it works for me is I get a directive from up above. And so I turn around and I say to my soldiers that are under me, do this, go there, accomplish this, and guess what? They do it. They do it because they're disciplined, and that's the nature of authority. And so, Lord, you don't need to come to my home. All you need to do is to pronounce the healing, and I know that it will be done. And Jesus is just blown away by this testimony. Jesus, who's time and time again is going out into the mission fields trying to teach and preach and get across to the people, this is who I am, and this is the nature of my authority. And yet beyond his own people, here you have a Gentile who's going, I get it. I get it. I respect it. I love it. Make it happen. And that's exactly what happened. Jesus pronounced the healing. The centurion went to his house and his servant was healed. It's a great story. Jesus marvels at his faith. Here's a question that I have for you. How do you think the disciples felt when Jesus pointed to him and said, what a great example. This is the paragon of faithfulness. How do you think the disciples felt? Well, let me take a stab at it. If I'm one of the disciples, I'm thinking, no, are you kidding me? I walked away from a perfectly good job. I left my loved ones behind. I've been following you all over creation, Lord, trying to learn and trying to imitate you and trying to understand the cryptic and mystical teachings that you have. I've been doing my very best. I'm trying to attain and find my place on your right hand so that when you rightfully come to your throne and you assume your kingship, I'm going to be right there, one of your favorite cabinet members. And yet you turn around and point to the enemy, a Roman soldier, and you say, this is the paragon of faithfulness. It must have been really hard to swallow. Because the way that we're taught as we're children and the way that we're raised, we're taught, don't consort with the enemy. Learn who the enemy is and don't consort with them. You know, this afternoon, the New York Giants are coming into town and they're playing the Dallas Cowboys. And on the sidelines for the Giants will be Coach Jason Garrett, who last year, as you know, was the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys. I wonder how that's going to feel for him. I wonder if he's going to feel strange. He'll feel like he's consorting with the enemy, but no, he's actually a New York Giant now. So this team that he knows so well and he cared so much for, now he wants to beat them. The Cowboys are the opposition. They're the enemy. You have to beat them. You know, and Coach Garrett, who, like Tom Landry before him, was a faithful member of this church and faithfully attended worship when he was able. How's he going to feel coming into Dallas? And we here in the church, we're above those types of things. We would never, you know, if he was going to be on the New York Giants, we don't have any problem with that. But if we were to find out that he became a Presbyterian, that'd be different. Don't go over and join those Calvinists now. That would be a problem. You see, we're taught that, and it makes sense to us. When I played high school football in Texas, we would get a scouting report every week about the other team. We had a scout team that played against us, scrimmaged us during the week. They wore their numbers. We called them by name. That was the enemy. We knew their star players. We had scouted them out well. So that when the time came for the pregame warm-up and we're out there and we look across the 50-yard line, we could recognize them by their number. We knew their names. We knew what they were capable of. We put on our game face. When one of them accidentally knocked their football on our side, we tossed it to them, but we didn't smile. We showed contempt, respect, but contempt, because they were the enemy. So imagine the disorientation for me when I went on to play small college football in the Midwest. And we drove up to Northfield, Minnesota to play the St. Olaf Northmen, their football team. And our bus pulled in right there at the field house. And we'd done the scouting report. We knew they had a running back by the name of Ole Gunderson. Ole Gunderson. Oh, my gosh. He can't be very good. Ole Gunderson, is that Norwegian? A football, that's a nothing. A ski humping, that's a something. That guy can't be any good at all. So we were ready. We had our game face on. The bus pulled up, the doors opened, and we walked out, and there was the entire St. Olaf football team there to greet us and welcome us and shake our hands. And it was totally unnerving. You're not supposed to do that. Go on the other side. You're the enemy. You're not supposed to shake our hands and welcome us. And they had a little Alpine band in Lederhosen. You know, they're playing the little pa music. You know, it seemed so sweet. And I just remember thinking to myself, man, we're going to kill these guys. They're just, not only are they awful, but they're stupid too. They're too friendly. They don't get it. You're supposed to go for the jugular. So it was with much optimism and expectation that we suited up, we went on the field, and let me tell you, they just beat the living daylights out of us. And Ole Gunderson ran for over 300 yards against us, and later was a draft pick of the Green Bay Packers. And I don't ever want to hear pa music again, because they played it every time they scored, and that's all we heard all day long. It's disorienting when somebody doesn't respect the boundaries. They don't play the game right. And you know what? Jesus colored outside the lines. Jesus either didn't get it or he didn't respect it. Because Jesus always moved outside the chosen. Jesus not only helped the soldier, the Roman centurion, but he talked to the Samaritan woman. You're not supposed to do that. Those Samaritans, they've got it wrong. They participate and embrace heresy. You're not supposed to talk to those people. Jesus, who went to have dinner at the home of a tax collector, those greedy people that are oppressing us and stealing our money, Jesus, don't talk to him. Jesus, who intervened when the woman was caught in adultery and was in the process of being stoned, Jesus always colored outside the lines. And it makes us want to ask Jesus, whose side are you on anyway? You know, there's actually documented accounts during the Civil War of churches that were within the territory of the Confederacy and churches that were during the territory of the Union. Sunday morning sermons, each one on the identical Sunday, 300 miles apart, with the preacher talking about how God is on their side. God embraces their cause. We've got God on our side. We want to know, Jesus, whose side are you on? It's a dichotomy. Are you with us or are you against us? We want Jesus to answer the question, who is our foe? Can we agree, Jesus, on the foe? Can we agree on the identity of the enemy? So then we can begin the process of demonizing that person or those people, and we can begin the process of forming the caricature to turn them into two-dimensional cartoons that make abundantly clear that those people aren't really human. You know, that strategy, that theological strategy was used in the so-called New World as Europeans came over to North America. When you could look out and see indigenous peoples who were not saved according to the faith, well, then it was a short jump from not being saved to really, you know, they're not really human. These people are savages. And if they're savages, they really aren't entitled to own property. And so it's well and good to take it from them. See how the process works? See how we began to go about the business of sabotaging the other side. There's actually a hilarious scene in the movie by Monty Python entitled Life of Brian, in which the Jewish rebels who are plotting the overthrow of the Romans during the time of Jesus, they're talking about kidnapping Pilate's wife and holding her for ransom. And they would continue to hold her for ransom until Pilate dismantled the Roman imperial estate, at which time they would release her. And then the head of the rebels, played ably by John Cleese, says, after all, what have the Romans ever done for us? And it's abundantly clear that it's a rhetorical question. He's not looking for an answer. But he gets a surprise answer for one person, and he hears, well, aqueducts. And he says, excuse me? He goes, well, you ask, what have the Romans ever done for us? They did bring us running water with the aqueducts. And another pipes in, and sanitation. Remember how filthy the roads were until they brought sanitation. So clearly disgusted, John Cleese goes, well, okay, sanitation and aqueducts, running water. But besides that, what have the Romans ever done for us? And somebody goes, well, public baths, and the roads are a lot better now. And the technology is good. And by the way, they did bring peace, which I think was one of the ultimate ironies of the Roman Empire. Because whereas in many lands, you had tribes that were fighting each other for centuries, fighting. It never went away. When the Romans came in with their incredible, monstrous presence, they took over. All of that went away. It was not allowed. And so you had what they referred to as Pax Romana, which is the peace of Rome. An interesting side effect of their empire. But Jesus, in this encounter with the centurion, wasn't concerned with all of that. Instead, he looked in the man's eyes, he listened to the man's words, he looked past the uniform into his heart, and he saw faith. And Jesus is always looking for faith. He sees every person as an individual. He doesn't ascribe characteristics of a collective to every individual within that collective. He understands that they're all different. And so he listened to this centurion, and he marveled at his faith. He didn't use flawed inductive reasoning by which he said, we're all aware of some instances in which Roman soldiers have brutalized citizens of Jerusalem, and consequently we understand all Roman soldiers are therefore evil. He didn't generalize. Instead, he dealt with people as individuals. The American humorist Will Rogers wore an interesting outfit, if you will. He was a cowboy. He wore boots and chaps and a cowboy hat when he did his Ziegfeld Follies show, and he would perform rope tricks. And while he did the rope tricks, he shared interesting insights, funny insights that contained a lot of wisdom. And Will Rogers was embraced by our nation. He was beloved. And the reason he was beloved was because of his personal motto, in which he said that he never met a person he didn't like. You think about that for a moment. How many of us can say that? He had never met a person he didn't like. In order to be able to pull that off, it seems to me that you have to begin the process by looking for something. By looking for some potential, some sign of redemptive quality, maybe, you know, what somebody might have been originally before they were so consumed with brokenness and so consumed with hostility and hate that they were reduced to the person before you right now. Will Rogers was not about cataloging shortcomings and pronouncing gotcha the moment he caught you doing something wrong. Instead, he focused on the common thread of our humanity. And that's why people felt close to him. That's why he never met a stranger. That's why people loved to be around him, because that's what he focused on. So this morning, I would invite you to share the confounding love of Jesus, to color outside the lines, to be able to say to yourself that at least this coming week, you have not met one person that you didn't like. And now we're going to close with our closing hymn, which is going to be Onward, Christian Soldiers. I'd like to sing it, I guess, partially in honor of the Roman centurion, But I also want to share a few words about that hymn. You know, there's understandably so, there's a stigma attached to the hymn, Onward, Christian Soldiers. Maybe because Winston Churchill used it in a service on a battleship in 1941 in which the military attended. And it took on the connotation that you're talking about anointing armies of Christians to go out and mount a crusade against other peoples and other faiths and to wage war on them. And as a result, you know, it's really outside the canon within the canon of the hymn book. I think it was in the late 80s we redid the Methodist hymn book. Initially, it was left out, and there was an outcry from the old guard, the traditionalists, and so it was placed back into the hymnal. And so we continue to have it in our hymn book. But in the words of one Presbyterian critic, and it's not in the Presbyterian hymn book, and he said, good riddance to it. That old hut, two, three, four melody that serenades these words that talk about crusades and images of militarization and battle. We don't need that in our hymn book. But to the extent that original intent matters, and I think it does, you need to be taken into account before you cancel something out. I think we should revisit what was the original intent of the hymn. First of all, it wasn't named Onward, Christian Soldiers. It was a procession of crosses and banners. It was written by an Anglican priest by the name of Sabine Baring Gould in Yorkshire. You see, he had an event coming up and he wanted some music for it. The event was they were going to have a procession of children that was going to go outside their church and go down the street, over a bridge, and go to another church. And they wanted some way, yes, it had a practical value, to keep the kids walking in order and marching together, but also they wanted to have a theme for it with these banners and these crosses. And so he wrote this song. And I think the key word in the entire hymn is the two-letter word as. Marching as to war. Let's elongate it. Marching as if they were going to war. But guess what? They're not going to war. I would invite you, as we sing this closing hymn, to have an image of Christopher Robin and maybe Tigger and Winnie the Pooh and all these stuffed animals and all these children marching in a procession, a phalanx of innocence, a squadron of mischievous joyfulness. And once you have the innocence of children banded together, marching from one church to another, I think seen in this light, this hymn will be quite useful. If you'll please join me in this closing hymn.